Good morning, everyone. My name is Todd Cochran, and you are watching Saturday Morning Tech. We have Dr. Bill from drbill.tv, the original computer curmudgeon. And of course, we've got Rob Greenlee on the bottom. Rob and Dr. Bill, good morning. How are you guys?
Doing great. Fantastic.
And Rob's been getting his butt kicked here by his webcam, so he's readjusting. And I think you're in a new location today. It looks a little different.
Yeah, I'm in my TV room.
Oh, okay. Is that your halo over his head there?
What's that?
Got a halo over your head.
Let me show
you.
Oh, I know. It's
fine vision.
There we go.
So that's not your man cave. That's your TV room, huh?
It's kind of one and the same.
Okay, cool. Well,
I'll show you.
Nice. Well, we're starting a little bit early today. I have to roll here in about 45 minutes, so we're going to get through the content pretty quickly today. I've got a number of articles we're going to talk about. And I guess I want to take just a moment, first things first, and thank our sponsor. You know, I've been using audible.com here for a long time. And Audible is a pretty amazing product in that whatever topic that you like to consume, they have it in an Audible book format. And they carry business titles, classics, fiction, history, romance, mystery thrillers, sci-fi, you name it. I like the business series and watch what's basically found social media stuff. And I pick up those types of books. But, you know, I find that spending a lot of time in traffic is not always conducive to one's goodwill. So I listen to a lot of Audible books when I'm, and of course podcasts too, when I'm mobile. But I think we got a great deal here for you. What you should do is you should go over to audiblepodcast.com. And all you got to do is really, once you get over there, and actually, oops, I forgot to give you the little code here. You go to audiblepodcast.com/morningtech, and you'll be able to get your a free 14-day trial. And this is the premium version of Audible. And what I find really is that it's just kind of cool. Every month I get a free book, and it's with 85,000 titles to choose from. It makes it real easy to stay abreast of some of the latest writings, and it's storytelling really at its best. So I don't know, have either of you guys used Audible at all in the past?
No, actually I don't. I just listen to podcasts.
Yeah, I think you're kind of in the, you know, that's your main job stay. So I imagine you have as much as you can handle on the listening front, don't you?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely. There's a lot of podcast content that needs to be consumed.
There is, you know, and my library continues to grow on that front too. It gets pretty crazy, but anyway, definitely check it out. audiblepodcast.com/morningtech. Well, how are you guys, how you been, Rob? It's been a couple of weeks. How's things going?
Well, it's going fine. You know, we're kind of in this kind of weird space of, as far as work wise of kind of planning and looking towards the future. And then also, you know, it's really exciting to see things around Windows 8 starting to, you know, move forward a little bit. So it's going to be an exciting week next week.
Did you see the blog post on The Verge?
Oh, yes. Oh, of course.
Yeah. I had that in the stack this morning. So we'll have to talk a little bit about that. And Dr. Bill, if you're not familiar with it, that here's the inflammatory title: How Microsoft is Killing Off the Zune and Windows Live Brands in Windows 8. So,
yeah, and, you know, I've got a lot of folks that subscribe through Zune and the Zune Marketplace. So I was like, oh, man, come on. We need that venue.
Rob, can you comment on that at all, or is that a topic not open for discussion right now? Or,
well, I can say that there's nothing really to worry about. Nothing is changing in reality. So I would just keep using the platform. It's not going to go away anytime soon. So, you know, there's really nothing to worry about as far as podcasters at this point. Zune, the whole Zune podcast area, there's nothing changing on that front at this point.
Well, that's good. Did, you know, what are they just trying to get page hits or something and point a finger, or what do you think their motivation there is?
Who is the
Verge
bloggers?
Yeah. The Verge. Yeah.
Well, I think what they're seeing is in the Windows 8 consumer preview, I guess they've been leaked some views of that, and there doesn't appear to be any kind of Zune related branding in that. So, but that's not to say that, I mean, that's not a final build of anything. So, you know, I can't confirm or deny a particular brand change on this front, but I just really have to caution everybody to say that, don't jump to conclusions until something has been formally announced.
You know, I think from my perspective, and I don't know about yours there, Dr. Bill, but looking at Windows 8, and I think the first thing I'll do when I get Windows 8 loaded is I'll, whatever I have to do to get back to the way my desktop looked before, I will probably do that. I don't know if I'm a big fan of this, you know, where this stuff is going to be in the middle of the screen. I guess maybe it has to grow on you. I don't know what, have you been looking at?
I've kind of got the same viewpoint. I'm just such an old Windows guy. I've been, you know, using it for years and years and years in its current paradigm, if you will, and a phone interface on a PC screen seems to me to be a little bit kludgy, but maybe that's because I'm an older guy and the younger folks, you know, really want to go in that direction. But I'm going to withhold judgment on it until I really see it in use and use it every day. My other real job is the corporate world, and I wonder how it's going to fly in the corporate world as well. You know, users are notoriously hard to retrain, and they're used to the desktop interface they've got. So I will kind of give Microsoft credit for being a little bit of a risk taker in this area, but I figure they've got to have a way to drop back to the regular desktop, or there's going to be a lot of corporations who just say, well, I'm just staying with Windows 7. And to be honest, we're still migrating at our, I work at a local hospital in IT, and we're still migrating to Windows 7. So from what I understand, that's kind of typical cross-corporate installations. It's just been a slow, slow transition, much slower than Microsoft, I know, would like, because Windows 7, to me, rocks.
Yeah, I like it a lot.
I really love it. I was not as enthusiastic about Vista, but they really heard from folks and fixed it in Windows 7. So I'm just going to wait and see on Windows 8.
No, Rob, you use a Windows phone every day. So the seam, you know, basic everything being seamless must be cool. But at the same point, I don't know. You know, how do you think this is going to transition, you know, when people are using this new desktop look?
Well, I think you all have to keep in mind that the company is not going to forget about its roots of being a, you know, an operating system with a desktop. So I think that's the key thing to keep in mind here, is that all these hundreds of millions of users that are used to the Windows desktop, it's really not in the company's best kind of direction and what its future is to ignore that legacy. But I think the company is trying to plow a new direction that is an alternative. And I think that as you think about mobile type, you know, slates and phones and things like that, there's kind of a different expectation of a user interface. And as you move more towards kind of natural user interface, like speech and motion and touch and those kind of things, that user experience is going to change. But I think that the company has a very strong view that there's a lot of, especially on the corporate side, and I think for a lot of just regular users, that that desktop is still an important piece of that. And I think you're going to see that legacy kind of continue for a while anyway.
Yeah, I would think so too. You know, it would have to, And I read somewhere where you could revert to the default desktop and it'd be more Windows 7-esque, I guess. But, you know, I'm running Windows 7 on this machine here, and it's right in front of me. And I've got another laptop that's got Windows Vista on it. And I can tell you that Windows Vista, you know, I get the old blue screen of death at least once a week with that. And very rarely have I ever had issues with Windows 7. You know, and I will definitely upgrade as soon as it's available. But I'm definitely not going to be, I don't know. I guess like Dr. Bill said, I'm going to have to reserve judgment on the operating system. You know, you look at what Apple's doing there. You know, they're trying to, you know, same thing, make everything seamless across all platforms. And, you know, they've made some announcements and they're hinting at some things. So we'll see where that ecosystem goes as well. Hey, I want to shift gears here just a little bit. There was an announcement yesterday that Sprint rejected an $8 billion Metro PCS acquisition. I guess just literally hours before the deal, the actual CEO of Sprint had signed off on it, but the board rejected it. And I thought, this is interesting. You know, Metro PCS, I'm not familiar with that specific company at all. It must be a regional cellular company. But reading through the over on Forbes and a couple of other places, they're on a completely different infrastructure. They're not on the same type of infrastructure as Sprint is. So I guess Metro PCS uses something called AWS, and I thought, wow, would have that $8 billion and they're going to go on they're going to have to completely revamp the infrastructure. It must be the board didn't feel like the additional customers was going to be worth it. Any thoughts on that? Or?
Well, I think it's just another example of some consolidation and you know, these smaller kind of sub operators like this, I don't know, are just going to be absorbed by the larger guys. So I think that's the takeaway.
You know, and we've been watching here, we've been T-Mobile users for, well, at least my wife has been for years, and she has been, you know, getting a little antsy with being on that carrier. And, you know, she comes home the other day, had this big revelation. She goes, did you know I could tether my phone and you could cancel my my iPad data plan, and if I got a data plan with T-Mobile, I could just tether. And I'm like, yeah, I've been trying to tell you that. And so she's finally discovered tethering. So now we're probably going to end up going down the route where she's a smartphone. And well, she's got an iPhone that's been jailbroke to run on T-Mobile, but I think, well, she's looking at a Droid. So we may have a Droid in the house. I don't know. Is there any Windows phones on T-Mobile there, Rob?
Yeah, there is. I think there's one or two, I think, right now.
That might be my way to get a Windows phone in the house. Maybe I can nudge that decision a little bit. I don't know. We'll have to see. But anyway, we'll see what she has to say. Hey, there was something I was going to... Oh, earlier this week... The president announced a new consumer privacy bill of rights. Well, he has basically recommended it, and it has some provisions. Have either of you went through and read what they're proposing be put in place?
No, I haven't actually seen this yet. I'm curious.
Well, it's broken down into seven segments. Individual control, transparency, respect for context. In other words, consumers have a right to expect that companies will collect, use, and disclose data in ways that are consistent with the context in which consumers provide the data. And another one is security, access, and accuracy, which is kind of an interesting one. Consumers have a right to access and correct personal data in usable formats in a manner that is appropriate to the sensitivity of the data. Number six, focused collection. So in other words, consumers have a right to reasonable limits on the personal data that companies collect and retain. And number seven, finally, is accountability, where consumers have a right to have personal data handled by companies with appropriate measures in place to assure they adhere to the consumer privacy bill. So those are the seven tenets. And of course, these are the, you know, the top layer of what he's proposing or what the administration's opposing. But at the same time, you know that once you turn this over to Congress and they add subparagraph 22, sentence or note 68, subclause 186, that this thing is going to get ugly. But they've introduced this and they considered it the Consumer Privacy Bill of Rights. And I think the attempt is notable. If Congress can keep their hands from meddling too deep, it might be good. But, you know, the question that this brings up, for me at least, and I don't know if you guys saw last week's show, but I had a couple of guys here locally on. We were talking about essentially tech at this point having not been very regulated. And would this Bill of Rights be really the first hardcore attempt to try to put some serious regulations in on the tech community?
I think it's probably about time that some of these things start to be formalized, because I think we're kind of reaching a tipping point with the online world that it's basically pervasive across the entire culture and population. And it just may be time to really start thinking about, you know, really establishing some rules, especially around privacy. It just seems like it's big enough now. It's not like this kind of growing niche area now. It's like pervasive. And I think, it's not a bad thing that there's probably some rules, as long as they're smart and intelligent and really thoughtful and not just overreaching because of some corporate interest.
Well, that's my worry, that it's going to get overreaching, you know, and I think that the tech community, you know, I get real nervous when they, you know, we've been able to innovate and move quicker because we don't have to have all this regulation. Now the question, you know, Dr. Bill, do you think this is going to stifle, you know, let's say they put all these rules together, what does that mean for a company like Raw Voice, who collects statistic data on podcast consumption? You know, am I all of a sudden going to have to put in opt-in rules and all kinds of different stuff?
Yeah, it's a fine line. I think I would rather see the control, if you will, be good corporate citizens of the internet, so to speak. Let the companies themselves, if they're legitimate companies, they're going to provide privacy rights, so to speak. And most websites have a section of privacy information. And I know at one time I ran an online business selling low-carb foods and so forth, and we had a whole page that had to do with, you know, this is your rights as a customer and so forth and so on. It really, if you're going to be a good internet citizen as a company, you're going to have some things in place to protect your customers because you want them to come back. Whereas if the government gets involved and starts kind of mandating certain things, I think you're right. I think some of it could, well-intentioned, no, don't get me wrong, but the well-intentioned ideas could be suppressive to particularly young companies like Raw Voice and so forth that are starting up and just really coming into their own. And that's my concern. I know there's got to be control, because I know there's some crazy things going on out there. But the Microsofts of the world and the larger companies, I think, are doing a good job of policing their own sites. And it's in their best interest to do that. So I just am a little nervous, like you are, of the government stepping in and in that. I like the fact that they're bringing attention to it as much as anything. Whether or not, like you say, Congress comes in and tries to regulate it, in the past, that's been a recipe for failure, unfortunately.
You know, I think the thing, and I'm, you know, I understand as much as you guys do that, you know, Google probably knows me better than my wife knows me, you know, from, true. You know, what we're doing on the internet, you know, and there is, you know, you think about the data that's being collected on us and how it's being used. I heard a pitch from, you know, just let's see if I can recap this here in a minute or so. So imagine you go to a site and there's a cookie dropped on your browser, and that cookie basically identifies you a certain way. And then because you did a certain type of purchase here, when you go to a different site, they automatically then have a little bit of data on you and could put 2 + 2 = 4, and they can start targeting. You know, we've already seen it where you're searching for stuff, and then a few days later you're on a site and, you know, something's being advertised to you in that search category. But I heard some absolutely insane stuff that's being done now where they essentially are going to be able to serve you a specific ad that really is going to probably scare the wits out of you when you see it. And it's happening a little bit already. So, you know, the individual control on what they're doing with what we're doing on the net is, to me, is big. You know, do I want, you know, I've told this story many times. My wife and my youngest son is 8 years old. And when she thought she was pregnant for him, she went to a local store, bought a pregnancy test kit with cash, not a credit card. And I think she used a credit card. And then it was positive, went to the hospital, had a pregnancy test done there, got a prescription for neonatal vitamins. Within 5 days of us knowing that we were pregnant, we received a parenting, and we'd been out of the baby business for a number of years, 7 years, and we received a congratulations Cochrane Family Parenting Magazine in the mail within just, you know, less than a week. And we both were like, this is a little bit spooky. You know, someone sold our information. So, you know, they know a lot about us. A lot. Does that unnerve
you? And the thing is, you can do a lot of things to protect yourself, block third-party cookies. You know, there's a lot of security things you can do to keep those kinds of things from happening.
I'm
a little less sensitive to it because I practically live on the internet. I mean, people know who I am and they know a lot about me just because I'm out there presenting information on shows like this and websites. So I don't have as high an expectation of total privacy, I guess. But I know there's a guy at work that I work with. He just refuses to even use Google or Google products because he's concerned about the privacy issues. And, you know, I am not that concerned, but I am aware of things like you're talking about, that you are being targeted.
Well, it's, you know, you look at what what Google did. And basically people had do not track turned on, you know, on IE and one other app, browser out there. And Google was circumventing that along with a lot of other sites were circumventing that do not track. And they were collecting the data irregardless of what you had set in your browser. You know, to me, that is just malicious to a certain extent.
Yeah, that's true.
I wanted to throw out,
go ahead.
You know, one thing for us to think about in the bigger picture of things with this whole conversation is, well, first of all, there's a lot of benefit that we all get from using online services out there. And right now, the vast majority of them are free. And I think one thing that we have to think about is, is, well, there is a price that we have to pay to get all of this benefit, right?
True.
And one of the prices that we pay is our privacy. And I guess that leads me to kind of the next question is, what is it about the privacy concern that is really that concerning to us all? I mean, is it just because we might get a freaky ad that may be closely associated to what's going on in our lives? Or is there some kind of bigger concern that we have that the government's going to know too much about us? And so I guess, you know, I'm kind of like you guys. I live my life on the web. I'm really conscious of what I put out on the web, and don't actively put stuff out there that I don't want people to know. But I also don't get the feeling like from these services that they're necessarily putting things out that I don't want them to possibly know. I mean, I don't know, and I'm probably willing to get an ad so I can get these free services.
Well, you know, look at it this way, Rob. At what point do they sell your information to, let's say, your insurance company, and you have been searching bungee
That's
jumping,
a good question.
Diving, you've been motorcycle, motocross, you have all these, let's see, you start doing high risk activities, you're searching for this, mountain climbing, all this different things that are, comes with an inherent bodily risk. And then all of a sudden your insurance company says, hey, by the way, we're upping your premium because you're in a higher risk category, and, pay us 50%. I don't think that's happened yet.
Is that the wrong thing? I mean, it's the same thing with putting like a tracker in your car. I know I've noticed that a couple of the insurance companies will say that if you put this little tracking device in your car, that you can get a lower premium.
But they opted in for that. They agreed to that, explicitly agreed.
But if you just know that every time you go online, that's the potential. And somehow down the line, if you can get some benefit from that as well, it may not necessarily be a bad thing.
But also, if you look at it at this point too, from time to time, I like to smoke a cigar, and I probably buy and give away more cigars than I have ever smoked. But, if I buy a box of cigars and smoke one, I'm out of it, and I give away, four or five of them, then all of a sudden, I might be prosecuted wrongly, from my insurance company. Oh, you're now a smoker, Yeah. Maybe I didn't even smoke, and I bought them when I was overseas someplace because someone asked me to.
You should pay higher premiums because you're smoking, Todd.
Well, but the thing is though, it's insurance companies are in risk management. They are in a business of they are playing a numbers game. And they should factor that into the premiums they charge everyone else and not target me directly. And that's part of the, I'm not necessarily a big fan of the president's healthcare bill, but that was part of his, that's part one provision within the healthcare bill that the insurance company couldn't discriminate. And I think insurance companies do, but, that's kind of getting a bit. I don't know. It is a slippery slope, and we'll have to see where, you look at, if you go back in the Carrier IQ folks, the firestorm that erupted from that, and they were tracking without our consent.
Yeah.
By text message.
Yeah, I agree. It needs to be, it needs to be put out there. It needs to be, if that's the value equation that these companies are expecting of us, the least they could do is tell us what they're doing. I mean, I totally agree with that.
Yeah, I think if people knew what they were really doing with the data, I think it would shock most of them, because most of them just don't have a clue.
Yeah.
They really don't.
Yeah, so you can make that personal choice of what information you're willing to put out there about yourself.
That's true.
I mean, I think that's really where it kind of gets back to the baseline. And if it's possible for me to get a discount on something that I want to buy, because Google or these other platforms pick it up that I'm looking at like buying a new car, or I'm looking at buying something, and they're able to deliver a coupon to me that saves me money in that shopping process, then that's not necessarily a bad thing for us. I mean, yep. It's just a matter of how that information is used and how clear these companies are about telling us what they're doing. So I think those things, then I think that the government has a role in making sure that that happens.
Well, we'll see how it washes out. We'll see where they get with this. And, you know, I'm just afraid what's going to happen when the senators and representatives get a hold of it. And they're a bunch of clueless. Well, I'll refrain from saying the rest of what I wanted to say. And it was going to start with an A, not an I.
Todd,
it's all a series of tubes. So,
yeah, exactly.
Todd, if you want to make a change, run for Congress.
No.
Yeah, I don't think so.
You know, that's one of those things where, oh, no.
You're not going there.
Okay. So let's change gears completely here. And the big admission by Sony Music CEO of International Business said in a recent interview that the internet is a blessing for the music industry. He says, nevertheless, there are problems that have to be overcome, such as restrictive copyright enforcement by music right collecting agencies. The Sony boss says that YouTube revenue is running into the millions is being lost because German rights group are preventing artists' videos from being shown online in the country. So here we have Sony coming out and say that they are making millions of dollars because of videos and stuff they're being put up on YouTube, and its censorship is bad. I mean, I'm floored. Is it the same group that is been taking down videos? And I mean, it just, to me, it's like, wow. But he was, you know, this is referring to specifically Germany, but that the internet is a
broader than Germany. Yeah.
The internet is a blessing for the music industry.
Well, it's perfect. I mean, we said all along, it's broader exposure for their music. And if you hear something you like, you go out and you buy that music. It's the whole theory behind why you have radio stations play music and people pick it up and purchase it from there. Now, the method of purchasing,
right?
I haven't bought a CD in years, but I buy electronic copies and have them stored in the cloud. It's just a different way of working, but they're still selling product.
Yep, I agree. But, you know, everything else you've heard from them up to this point has been, oh, the internet's killing us. Well, piracy is, but it is an interesting comment here. Hey, I should have actually brought this up when we were talking about the last topic, but the Reddit writers, or the Reddit community, has come up with the first draft of the Free Internet Act. So this is a response to SOPA, ACTA, to PETA. Every time I hear PETA, I think about the Prince of Wales' wife's sister. I don't know why I think of her every time I hear the word PETA, but... anyway, I digress. So they're writing this, and they're saying the Free Internet Act is to promote prosperity, creativity, entrepreneurship, and innovation by preventing the restriction of liberty and preventing the means of censorship. FIA will allow the internet users to browse freely without any means of censorship. Users have right to free speech and free knowledge, and we govern the content of the internet. Governments don't. However, enforcement laws must also be put in place to protect copyright content. So that's kind of interesting. They actually, you know, throw a bone to, you know, the groups trying that are worried about the copyright issue. And the Huffington Post, as much as I don't care for Arianna Huffington, There's a good background article on the, how the bill was developed. It's available. And but the community is finally waking up a little bit. Do you think that, you know, and this goes back again to our conversation last week, do you think tech companies have been so focused on their trade that they have stuck their heads in the sand and basically have allowed the legislative process just to run us over?
I think a lot of companies are actually demanding, quote, something be done to protect copyright. And that's why we're seeing SOPA and PIPA and all these different things being proposed in response to companies that are demanding it. But again, I think it's like the manufacturers of buggy whips. They're going to have to realize the paradigm has shifted. We've moved on, and you need to come up with a plan that works to sell your product.
But Dr. Bill, doesn't...
I'm all for copyright protection. Don't get me wrong, but we've got to innovate.
But doesn't, you know, the bigger point I'm trying to make here is that the reason SOPA and PIPA was so bad is because we did not hold people's feet to the fire in the writing of those. We were not actively politically in tech. You know, I don't think a lot of tech companies like to be active politically. And I guess the point I'm making is that where we're missing the boat?
Well, Todd, I think it depends on who you're talking about. I think if you're talking about the kind of the bigger tech companies, they are very much engaged in this. If you're talking about, you know, folks like us who have, you know, kind of rallying around kind of like a more kind of user focused kind of, that part of it has not necessarily been part of the discussion. I think it's been more of a corporation business to the government, and really hasn't really made a strong kind of connection with the average population as far as what their opinions are of these things. And I think that what's driving this stuff is the corporate side, and really the folks that have a reason to be concerned and wanting to control their copyright, right?
Yeah.
So those are the people that are driving this discussion. And I think what happened here recently with this kind of, you know, this uprising that happened on the internet really showed that the folks on the web can really get involved in this process. And I think that needs to happen more. But it seems like it's going to be so rare that these type of uproars can happen because smaller issues come up that just don't get that kind of attention. So it's just kind of this big buildup that has to happen before it raises the awareness of millions of people versus just the awareness of the larger companies that have an interest in this. So,
yeah. I know that I'm going to be getting a little more active on the legislative side. We formed a group here in Hawaii, and we're going to be tracking bills, and we're going to be sending input and sending people. And it's, you know, and we grew pretty quickly. 500 and some folks here in Hawaii have jumped on a group, and we're going to watch. And we're going to make sure that if something does come to the table, that at least we get in there and put our feelings in and go have discussions and give them the, you know, the technical merits of whether this bill is good or bad and what, how it's going to impact business. And so we're getting active here, at least in Hawaii. And I hope that people do that in their own states as well and pay attention to this stuff. And, you know, we're, you know, kind of a unique here that our geographically, we're not that big. So it's not like it's, you know, I can get in my car and I can literally in 30 minutes, I can be at the state capitol, and almost anyone that lives in Oahu is in the same boat. And those that are on the outer islands, they can, you know, 45 minutes, they can be on an airplane and over here. So, so maybe geographically it's going to work for us better too, because we'll be able to go and bang on our reps' doors and say, hey, what are you doing? And let's talk about this. But, I think we're just going to have to watch all this stuff that's going on through, because if they're not going to get us federally, they're going to whack-a-mole at us on the state side.
At state level.
Yeah. Yep. Hey, let me talk. I've got about 10 minutes here before we have to wrap today. But I want to talk about Apple and this Foxconn and them sending out the Fair Labor Association. Of course, I've talked about this a lot on my show, but Apple paid and joined the Fair Labor Association, paid Fair Labor $250,000. They're supposedly a nonprofit company that is supposed to do conduct investigations on fair labor standards. So what do you think about this whole Foxconn and Apple? And of course, Apple's the whipping boy right now. There's a lot of other companies that are out there that are using basically Chinese labor for cheap. What do you guys, any thoughts on what's been going on in that front?
Well, I think what's happening over there is not necessarily good for anybody. I mean, I think least of all good for the people in China. But I think we are the beneficiaries of the products that come out of there.
Cheap
because
stuff.
Of the low cost, low prices that we pay for this stuff. And I think, I don't know about you guys, but I'm certainly willing to pay a little bit more for my electronics if it means that people in China and other places around the world can live a little bit better lives.
Sadly, though, I think, you know, me paying $10 more for an iPhone or $20 more for an iPad, you know, in the scheme of things, probably doesn't result in a very substantial increase over there. Right? I think in order to, you know, if you really want to get the standard of living up, you're going to have wages on par with the United States, and then your products are not going to be affordable anymore. So there's a double-edged sword to this.
Or they'll be made in the United States again.
Wow. Isn't that a novel idea? Dr. Bill, any you've been following this at all?
I was just looking at a Reuters story here, and the headline is Foxconn jobs are still in hot demand despite the labor probe. The folks in China are basically clamoring to work there. You know, it is bad, and by our standards, it's a bad situation,
right, right.
No question. But the kinds of jobs that are available elsewhere, by comparison, these are better jobs
for them.
Now, that's not to say it ought to remain that way by any stretch, but I think we tend to have a westernized view of what's good and what's bad from their perspective. Why are you fussing at our employer? This is a great place to work.
Yeah.
You know, by comparison. But I did hear a great commentary this morning on NPR on their weekend edition. And the speaker there, whoever it was saying that his personal viewpoint is that, as you said, he's willing to pay a little bit more so that they have better working conditions. I think all of us want to see people have happy, productive lives. That's what we're about over here, is the pursuit of happiness and life and liberty in the United States. I'd love to see that for the rest of the world, but a lot of it's going to depend on them and their government and their standing up for their own rights. We can be there to help, but I don't think we can impose until it has to come from within, I guess is what I'm saying. Well, we can be supportive, but that's what I'm thinking.
Well, one thing we have to remember, it's still people think of China's this great place to do business in, but it's still a communist country, still centrally controlled by a very small group of people. And, I saw a statistic where there is tremendous pressure in China to employ people. And they have to add 20. Now, you know, talk about hearing the president saying we added 3 million jobs over the past 3 years. And that was fantastic. In China, they have to add 25 million new jobs every year. They have to. If they don't add 25 million new jobs a year, they are going to be in very serious trouble. So this is one of the reasons why, you know, all the money that's been going to China out of our pockets that has been going in is being used to build cities that are empty. And I don't know if you want to see something astonishing, just do some Google searches for ghost cities in China, and you'll be just your jaw will drop. And but still, they just think about that. They have to have 25 million people come on the payroll every year, or they're facing chaos. And you know, it's somewhere. There's only so much consumption in the world. They don't have a problem hiring people. You know, they have 20,000 people line up for job interviews. So it's not like people don't want to work there either, like you said, Dr. Bill.
Yeah. Well, there's 1.3 billion people there. So you can imagine that there's just this backlog of people that want to work and raise their standard of living. And so that's what's really, really driving this. And it just, you know, that's what causes those companies over there to just treat people almost like cattle, right?
I mean, slaves.
They just come and go because there's more behind them. So they feel like they can just take advantage of them.
And another thing too, it's a situation where a lot of those factories are in rural China. They're not in cities. They are, you know, way outside major economic centers. And China has rules where if you want to move from the rural area, the country, to the city, you actually have to have a permit to do so. You cannot just pick up your stuff and move. Many do, but then they end up in true sweatshops because they're not basically documented workers within cities and can't get many of the better jobs. So there's a lot of opportunism going on over there. So I think it's the wild, wild west. And as much as we want to hope Apple and these other companies will take care of these employees, it's until you've been there, or been in a third world country and see how poverty really is. And believe me, it can be pretty awful. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what happens with this. But I did find it a little disingenuous that Apple would pay $250,000 to join the Fair Labor Association and then have them go over and do the inspection. I was like, okay, that's. Hey Rob, why don't I pay you $100,000 and you come over here and inspect my working space and tell me how good or bad I'm doing, you know?
There's a little bit of conflict of interest there.
Just a little. You know, it's another thing if I put money in an escrow account somewhere and say, okay, this will pay for an inspection, and you have a third party to do the inspection. That's one thing, but just to give money, well, you know, I guess it's, we'll see. I'm looking forward to reading the report in March.
Well, one question that keeps coming up in my mind as I think about this is that if you think kind of down the line here, are these type of things going to possibly put the kind of the manufacturing sector for U.S. products in China kind of a little bit on edge here from the standpoint of, you know, if these things continue and the perception gets so bad about it that these companies really have to start thinking about making their products other places. And so ultimately, will that force China to make changes? Or do you think that China won't make these changes and ultimately the manufacturing of these products will move to like India or back to the U.S. or some other country around the world?
Well, if you look at history, there was about 20 or 25 years ago, every piece of thing you picked up said made in Japan.
Yeah.
The labor was cheap. The people there were, you know, the economy was coming out of, believe it or not, if you think about it, 25 years ago, Japan was still in post-World War II recovery. So stuff was coming out of Japan cheap. And now today, manufacturing is leaving Japan because the economy has grown into a, you know, a first world nation status, and you know, things are expensive. So, you know, they've moved stuff to Malaysia, Philippines, different places, and there's only so many. Well, what'll end up happening, Rob, instead of being in China, we'll be somewhere in Africa or something like that, some other poor third world nation where we can take advantage of the workforce. And the Americans like their stuff too cheap. I don't see this cycle of oppressing people changing anytime soon. And maybe I shouldn't say oppressing people, but you're going to go where the cheapest workforce is.
Yeah, or, I mean, look at what's happened to the U.S., you know, automotive industry. I mean, it was brought back into play here in the United States. I would like to think that this could be brought back to the U.S. at some point.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a tough sell with benefits and unions, and there's no union at Foxconn. You don't do the work, you get fired. You know?
Yeah, I'm sure.
There's someone else standing in line. Ultimately, maybe we'll end up being a third world country again, and we'll be the ones that China's hiring to build their stuff.
Yeah, that's a scary thought.
That's very scary. Well, guys, anything that you guys saw come to mind the past week that you thought was noteworthy here in our closing minutes?
Oh, there's always stuff going on, Todd. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Well,
so there's there's been more talk about about the whole podcasting name needs to be changed and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of a continuing dialogue online here as far as what needs to happen next with podcasting. So I don't know if you've been hearing that too, Todd.
It's podcasting's healthy. It's growing. People are consuming it more than they ever have, irregardless of what they call it. That's the thing that's important to me.
I actually
got an invitation to a film and television production community because of my netcast, and I call them netcast. I go with Leo on that, because pod to me does seem to kind of limit it to the iPod, although I understand its roots. But at the same time, really, we're becoming just broadcasters. Yeah. And it's interesting that the broadcast community is beginning to take note of those of us that are doing video over the web.
Yeah, I think what it is we're starting, you know, some of us or some shows are starting to, you know, as much as they didn't want to be like mainstream media, there's this, I guess, conversion.
Yeah, there's a blending that's happening, right?
Yeah.
These things are coming together. And I think that's, if you look out a couple of years in the future, I don't think that you're going to see a huge distinction between what is being done here and what's being done, as part of a TV show. I think that the both sides are converging on each other, and there's not going to be a huge difference down the line.
Yeah. So. There's a huge appetite for content. So I think, I think people are creating content are in a great position right now. Hey, gents, I really got to wrap here. Thanks for being with me. I know that we had a little bit of a bridge show, but and a little earlier start. For those of you that are just jumping in here this morning, I apologize. We had to start early. I have to blast. I actually need to leave the house here in the next 10 minutes or so. But you've been watching Saturday Morning Tech. You can check us out over at geeknewscentral.com. Of course, definitely check out Dr. Bill's show. Dr. Bill's over at drbill.tv. And let's see if I can put up the little lower third there for you. And also drbill.cc as well, right?
Right. .tv is our video site. Drbill.cc is our blog. And, of course, we have links from there over to the video. So we've got a lot of geeky things happening this week. So check it out.
And of course, Rob, they can find you at robgreenlee.com. Of course, you're also over there at Zune. So if podcasters have issues, they can rob@zune.net. Anything else going on?
That's about it for now. It's the podcast area is still growing well on Windows Phone. So keep the podcast coming.
And we definitely will. And of course, again, my name is Todd Cochran. Definitely check us out at geeknewscenter.com. You can email me geeknews@gmail.com. Of course, you can reach me on Twitter @geeknews. Our hotline is 619-342-7365. Guys, have a great week. And thanks for hanging out with me here this on Saturday morning tech. Everyone else, take care. And aloha. Okay, stream is still up, but the recorders have stopped. At least I'm stopping them.
Yeah, even when we're off the air, we're not off the air.